that managed to launch a significant industrial revolution by the 1890s. The process can be compared both in terms of what they had in common and how they managed the process in similar ways, and obviously also how the process differed and had different results. Revolution in Russia's case, for example, not so in Japan. But I like the Japanese-Chinese comparison for a couple of key reasons. First of all, pretty obviously, it is a key contrast between a society that introduced a surprisingly successful series of reforms, the Japanese case, and a society that was unusually laggard. Comparison of extremes, perhaps, but a comparison nevertheless. Second, and this goes back to something we touched on earlier, we're dealing here with two societies that shared a good bit. Japan had been massively influenced by China. It was by this point a Confucian society culturally, as was China. The extent to which the two societies had participated, if not in a single civilization orbit, at least in very close interaction, raises particularly acute questions of why one experience would differ so much from the other. And the final reason to emphasize this comparison is because it had such significant impacts for the 20th and even the 21st centuries. And we will, at the end, move from the long 19th century comparison to an evocation of the subsequent implications as well. Both Japan and China were essentially forced into a reform mode, or rather a consideration of the need for reform, the consideration of the need to find some new way to deal with new Western power by developments toward the middle of the 19th century. We've already noted the importance of the First Opium War beginning in 1839 in bringing the Chinese to realize that the West now had a military force that was capable of unseating Chinese policy intentions and Chinese traditions. The Chinese also had to come to realize that the West was so eager to gain access to Chinese wealth and markets that it would push virtually any kind of product that would accomplish this end. And opium was obviously a case in point. Japan's introduction was a little later and possibly a little less crude, and maybe here is one of the reasons for different experiences later on. But Japan also was forced. The arrival of Western fleets from the United States, Britain, and elsewhere, the arrival of Western fleets was not merely a hollow demonstration, would you please open your markets? It was a statement, if you don't, we will come in with force. And there were actual military clashes during the ensuing couple of decades between Western forces and those of Japan. And there were ongoing Western constraints on Japanese activity. Westerners planted in Japan, for example, to insist on regulation of Japanese tariff policy. These constraints would ease only in the early 20th century. So forced entry, unwelcome intrusion are factors in both cases. Now, in theory, possibly even in history, one might have expected the Chinese to react more successfully than the Japanese. After all, it was China that had the great political tradition. Japan had patched up its politics under the Tokugawa shogunate, but nobody would point to the Japanese state as a world model at this juncture. The Chinese also had its tradition of technological superiority that it might call on. The Japanese, although certainly not big technological laggards, had fewer inventions to point to their credit. Perhaps most interestingly of all, and this is a factor that continues to color the Japanese experience, Japan was, in terms of responding to the industrial pressure from the West, Japan was resource poor. It had small holdings of coal, but insufficient fuel supplies really to sustain an industrial revolution. It needed to support other kinds of materials, cotton, for example, metal ores, in ways that China did not. China's advantages here were considerable and maybe over time will win out. But for the moment, the first proposition is, as both societies were forced into the consideration of change, Japan might have been expected to have a great deal more trouble. Japan did, of course, have some assets. Unlike China, its 18th century experience had begun to move toward a bit more openness to foreign influence. China had done the reverse. Japan had moved more clearly toward dissemination of education in the Confucian or Buddhist mold than had China, where education was still reserved more exclusively for members of the elite. These advantages and others may begin to help tell the story of why reactions differed. Beginning in 1868, after 15 years of real debate and near civil war over what to do, with many upper-class Japanese samurai advocating a resistance to the West and only gradually being forced to concede victory to the forces of reform, also from the upper classes. In 1868, Japan launched on a major series of reforms that go under the heading the Meiji Era. Meiji means enlightened. There was a new emperor known as Meiji or the Enlightened One. Most of the reforms were actually not dictated by the emperor, but by talented advisors around him, some of whom had active exposure to the West. Japan began, even before 1868, to send certain observers to the United States and Western Europe to find out what went on there and what might be emulated. The Meiji era included reforms in really an impressive variety of categories. Politics was obviously one. In 1868, the feudal system was abolished. And gradually, over the next couple of decades, the Japanese evolved a system of parliamentary monarchy with a constitution based on limited suffrage, but with a parliament that looked, indeed the parliamentarians dressed, very much in the Western fashion. Japan managed also to begin to forge a new kind of elite that, among other things, would dominate the government, an elite which continued to include representatives of the military of the old feudal classes, although no longer officially titled, but with a strong admixture from newer business elements and some intellectuals, creating an upper class that was arguably more flexible, more open to change, while not exactly immune to tradition at the same time. Political change was joined by a number of other kinds of reform. Obviously, early attention went to changes in the military. Japanese began to create a European-style military structure. They began to create a modern navy. They upgraded the technology of their military. Infrastructure was also modernized quite quickly. Railroad networks were established that really, along with new kinds of shipping, unified the various islands that make up Japan to a much greater extent than had ever been possible before. I'd mentioned previously Japanese enthusiasm for new public health measures that began to permit the rapid expansion of Japanese population, a problem ultimately, but a source of strength as well. In 1872, the Japanese mandated a mass education system, revealingly requiring school attendance not only for boys but for girls, a major departure in Japanese tradition. It took 15, 20 years for this school system really to reach mass proportions. Even the Japanese could not work overnight miracles. But by the 1890s, relevant age groups really were literate, really were schooled in ways that had no precedent in Japanese experience prior to that time. Educational reform also included significant modifications of the Confucian intellectual tradition. A major educational reformer, Fukuzawa, argued explicitly that Confucianism was holding Japan back because of its hostility to new kinds of science and its insistence on the hold of tradition over newer or creative thinking. Fukuzawa was not an entire innovator. He would also periodically recognize the value of Confucian traditions, but there was no question, particularly for the upper classes, for the talented elite, Japan increasingly opened educational opportunities that would emphasize scientific and technical training and also schooling in modern languages headed by English and German in ways, again, that were quite new in the Japanese experience. Japanese enthusiasm for change extended quickly to consumer items. Although Japan, partly for reasons still of lower standards of living, hardly became a Western consumer paradise immediately, enthusiasm for products like toothpaste, for example, grew quite rapidly by the 1880s, and by 1900, department stores were establishing themselves in sections of Tokyo that were particularly seen as windows into the newer kind of life. This reform and its broad, sweeping nature, its application to so many different aspects of life, really needs to be emphasized. This reform, however, was not a complete cave-in to Westernization. A specific example cropped up again in the field of education in the 1880s. In the 1870s, after the 1872 education measure, for a brief span of years, the Japanese really seemed bent on creating a Western education system. They imported Western teachers. They imported a professor from Rutgers University to head the system. This looked like Westernization in the making. But in the 1880s, under imperial leadership, they pulled back. Mass education remained. Scientific and technical emphasis remained, but Western books in the social sciences were increasingly restricted. Japanese textbooks were written, and the guiding theme here was the importance of maintaining Japanese traditions, new or old, that emphasized group loyalty, loyalty to the emperor, as opposed to Western individualism, Western skepticism, values that were seen as hostile to Japanese development and political stability. Finally, of course, the reforms included a massive effort at industrialization outright. By the 1890s, Japan was beginning to establish a significant factory system, strong emphasis, of course, on export production because Japan could only survive by producing enough for world markets that it could afford the fuels and equipment that were needed for industrialization to operate effectively. Japanese industrialization was stimulated by high taxes on the peasantry, which helped free up funds for investment, by poor working conditions, massive utilization of women workers for silk manufacture was involved here, in frankly near servile conditions, with young girls bought from their families and taken to sweatshops where they were housed and regulated by their employers. But the use of silk for exports and the capacity to seize a good bit of the silk export market from the Chinese by concentrating on it, by using modest changes in equipment, provided vital opportunities for foreign earnings and capital formation that in turn would fuel a more general industrial development in the future. By the early 1900s, the Japanese were capable not only of making modern steamships, but also modern trains. By the second decade of the 20th century, Japanese industrialization would be moving into a heavy industrialization as well as light export industry phase, and the process was off and running in a pattern that would yield ultimate share of world industrial leadership to the Japanese by the second half of the 20th century. China's pattern, of course, was vastly different. There was no clear decision to embark on reform. The first railway line built in China by a private outfit was actually torn up by the government that just was resistant to this kind of technical progress, this kind of imitation of outside example. The Chinese were modestly interested in Western military innovations, but without a more thoroughgoing reform pattern, they simply couldn't afford or organize the kind of military and political changes that would allow them to catch up to Western standards. Hesitation, hostility were part of a pattern of hesitation that has led one historian, Michael Gaster, to write a book about China's struggle to modernize, an interesting title that sort of captures the spirit of this age. China's responses were obviously further complicated by massive internal unrest in the middle of the 19th century. Civil war broke out between the forces of the government and a new kind of semi-Christian religious group that led to massive levels of death and dislocation. China's reactions were hampered, obviously, by the increasing tendency of most of the Western powers and Russia to seize chunks of Chinese territory, where they did indeed, for example, around Shanghai, develop new kinds of industry, but industry under Western rather than Chinese control. These intrusions on Chinese territory reduced Chinese economic capacity, particularly in some of the areas that were most accessible to foreign trade. They caused consternation. They caused increased hostility to the foreigners themselves. The Boxer Rebellion would be a manifestation, a quite understandable manifestation of anti-foreign hostility that tended to channel passions in ways that the Japanese were devoting rather to reform efforts. Only gradually, beginning in the 1890s, did the Chinese begin to organize, and organize may already seem too formal, did the Chinese begin to see more concerted efforts to come to terms with the new situation. It was at this point, for example, that significant numbers of university students began to go from China to places like Japan or the United States. It was at this point that Christian missionary activity began to have some impact in setting up new kinds of educational institutions in China proper. It was at this point, interestingly, that foreign criticism combined with some Chinese reform sentiment directly to begin to attack the old practice of foot binding, which would now gradually decline. So there was reaction, but it was late and it was obviously incomplete, and it contrasts quite markedly with what was going on in Japan. So, why? Explanation, I think, is predictably complicated because, again, one might have assumed that China's response would have been more effective than the Japanese, but here are some components. Obviously, though there's a chicken and egg element here, Western encroachments on China were much more unsettling than those on Japan, partly because the West had an older historical thirst for Chinese access. The Japanese produced some goods the West wanted, but there was less pent-up demand for interference. And that may have helped provide some breathing room for the Japanese. Quite clearly also, and here there's an element, I think, of historical accident, quite clearly also, Western intervention caught Japan and China in different phases of a political cycle. The Chinese were in one of their periodic political doldrums. They don't happen too often, but they were happening to the Qing dynasty by the middle of the 19th century, and this meant that Western intrusion was less opposed, less effectively opposed. The Chinese wrote eloquent letters, for example, protesting the Opium War and the introduction of opium, but they were pretty powerless to do much, partly because their government was so debilitated by that juncture. The Tokugawa shogunate had its own problems. There was some social unrest from the later 18th century onward. There were periodic problems with collecting sufficient tax revenue, but the Japanese state encountered the West at a point of greater strength. It needed to be revamped. That's what the Meiji reforms in the political arena did. But there was more intrinsic strength in the first place. One can also suggest, and we've hinted at this already, that although Japan and China both operated within a Confucian tradition, Japanese Confucianism had been somewhat less traditionalist, somewhat less bent on absolute resistance to foreign influence, and more interested than the Chinese tradition in spreading the benefits of education at least slightly more widely than the elite itself. Japanese feudalism, something that was absent from Chinese tradition at least since the middle of the classical period. Japanese feudalism may have created an advantage in two respects. First of all, the extent to which feudal classes remained in Japan gave Japan a quicker appreciation of the military aspects of the Western challenge than occurred in China, where the military simply, although possessed of an impressive tradition, where the military simply had less voice. Japanese feudalism may also have created types of group loyalties that could be utilized for industrialization, that could be utilized for political action, even in a newer parliamentary system. China didn't have this tradition, and obviously that may have been a factor as well. Very simply, Japan had a history, although not a recent one, of successful imitation, and China did not. Japanese could know from their earlier interactions with China itself, Japanese could know that it was possible to imitate without losing your identity, without surrendering to foreigners. China's one big experience of imitation, the importation of Buddhism, had ended fairly badly. Their experience with the Mongols had, in their opinion, ended fairly badly. And there was no tradition of a sense of fruitful interaction with influences from the outside, and every reason in terms of Chinese tradition to be very suspicious of this kind of possibility. Unquestionably, when you add up traditions of imitation, political effectiveness, possibly even an element of transformed military feudalism, without question, the Japanese managed to borrow from the West while controlling Western influence much more effectively than any other non-Western society in the long 19th century. Of course, the Japanese copied from the West. Of course, they imported Western educational and military advisors. And of course, every so often, they seemed to indulge in almost silly kinds of consumer fads, orgies of interest in Western styles and fashion. But the Japanese managed fairly carefully to regulate the actual levels of Western ownership during industrialization. They had to borrow from the West. They had to import Western technologies, but far more effectively, for example, than the Russians in the same period. Actual Western ownership was limited, and as we've seen in the educational sphere, actual Western influence was modified by an insistence on a mixture of old and invented traditions of Japanese group loyalty, solidarity, emperor worship, and that sort of thing. The difference between Japan and China was not simply a sterile exercise in 19th century dynamics. It obviously, by the end of the 19th century, had very real consequences. In the 1890s, Japan and China went to war directly. And to everybody's surprise except that of the Japanese won fairly handily. They had the modern military. They had already sufficient industrial strength to fuel the modern military. They had a navy that was superior to that of China. They beat the Chinese and began to establish, as a result, the pattern of Japanese influence in Korea, which was one of the areas of contest that would be such an important aspect of Japanese policy and Korean experience on into the Second World War. Japan would soon also confront Russia, also over bragging rights and power relationships in the Pacific, in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-5. And again, to everybody's surprise except that of the Japanese won that also. Russia, although industrializing, remained a more cumbersome society, had more trouble bringing military force to bear in the Pacific than did the Japanese who were there, who were more effective industrially already at this point, etc. So, power balances began to shift as the Japanese began to make their own claim into a global power, or at least a strong regional power relationship that was very, very new in terms of Japanese history. The result was, obviously, a series of tensions between Japan and China that began to translate comparative differences into ongoing military hostilities that would extend into the renewed Japanese attack on China in the 1930s, would extend into World War II, and even today marks continued hostility and tension and anxiety between these two significant Asian powers. A somewhat less concrete but also very real result of the different paths of Japan and China in the long 19th century involves social stability. Japan's reform pattern, remember it had a near civil war that helped sort out some tensions before the reform sequence began in earnest. Japan's reform experience, including its industrialization, created massive social tension. There were lots of Japanese who worried that valued traditions were being lost. There were lots of Japanese exploited workers who sought to express themselves in social protest only to be repressed, often rather brutally, by the government. So this was not an easy process or one in which the Japanese waltzed nicely into modernity. But the Japanese did manage to effect significant change without complete social upheaval. The Chinese experience here, obviously, was quite different. without trying to make a revolutionary outcome seem absolutely inevitable. It seemed to many Chinese leaders, to many reform-minded Chinese, by the second decade of the 20th century, that the only way China was going to be able to get off the dime, the only way China was going to be able to mount a successful response to Western intrusion and Western example, was through outright revolution, through a major forcible change in Chinese political, social, and cultural structures. This is what happened in China. This, too, would differentiate Chinese and Japanese experience, not only in the middle of the 20th century, but in ways that continue to reverberate. The Japanese experience at the end of the long 19th century was long really unique. Japan is an absolutely fascinating but unusual case of significant response to outside stimulus without totally losing identity. Again, modernization without full westernization. And it needs to be taken not only as an important addition to the roster of industrial and military powers of the modern world, but as a fascinating example of a capacity to change constructively without, again, collapsing all signs of traditional identity. China's case, although an extreme, the Chinese sluggishness in responding to outside challenge, which we've tried briefly to explain, was greater than that of many other societies. China's case was, however, in many ways the more typical. Lots of societies, for various specific reasons, had difficulty coming to terms with what the West was now suggesting was necessary for effective political and economic operation. But, equally obviously, one final point. The Chinese deficit here, if that's a fair term for their difficulties of the later 19th century. The Chinese deficit here was not permanent. We're talking here about a century or so of clear disarray and confusion, mixing internal tensions with the force of outside intrusion and exploitation. But this was not the last stage in China's modern story. And when we pick up, beginning next time, with the advent of the final period in world history, we will have, among other things, not only to recognize the significance of Japan's ongoing role and its example of modernization without absolute loss of identity, but the growing muscle of China in world affairs as well.
Lecture 29, The 20th and 21st Centuries as a New Period.
We're talking today about the 20th and 21st centuries as a new period in world history. This is the first of eight discussions we'll have about contemporary developments in world history's perspective, and indeed the period is best known as the contemporary period because although it began in the 20th century, in most respects it seems to be continuing into the 21st. For how long, we obviously don't know. Any new period in world history raises issues of selection of major themes. It's never magical or automatic to make sure you've identified the right things. But this new period in world history is obviously particularly challenging, and I always stress with world history teachers that if they don't find the 20th, 21st centuries the hardest, possibly the most interesting, but the hardest period to deal with, they may be doing something wrong. There are several ways to state the challenges. The first one, and I really want to mention this, though it's a little bit oblique to the main point. The first one is to make sure that as we talk about developments over the past century, we make sure to maintain contact with earlier patterns, with the characteristics of some of the individual major civilizations, with earlier processes that had been established in world history, because there's a danger of all of a sudden jumping into the excitement of change and tumult and forgetting that there is a history that went before. So this is a new period.